Welcome, everyone, to this week's Citizens Climate Training Program. It's a weekly webinars of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth learning opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is carbon pricing in a post-Inflation Reduction Act world. Now that the Inflation Reduction Act, henceforth known as IRA here tonight, has changed the climate policy and clean technology landscape in the United States, prior modeling about the effectiveness of policies like a carbon price have become outdated. Fortunately, there are new reports that have been published to outline the emission reduction potential of several climate policies in a post-IRA world, including carbon pricing. We're going to be joined tonight by the amazing CCL research coordinator, Dana Nucitelli, for a training about this important new research. So let me introduce my friend and colleague, Dana, and then pass it to him. Dana is CCL's research coordinator for Citizens Climate Lobby. He is an environmental scientist with degrees in astrophysics and physics from UC Berkeley and UC Davis. He's also a climate journalist for Skeptical Science, The Guardian, and Yale Climate Connections. He is the 2016 NCSE Friends of the Earth Award winner and a recent SEAL Award winner, a prestigious journalism climate journalism prize, too, that we're really proud of Dana for receiving, as well the author of 10 peer-reviewed climate science papers. So we're in great hands tonight.
All right. Thanks, Brett. Welcome, everybody. So we're going to do three things tonight. We're going to talk about why the Inflation Reduction Act changed the climate policy and emissions landscape in the United States, and then how a carbon price will impact climate pollution in a post-IRA world. And then we'll talk at the end about what's next for federal carbon policies, carbon pricing policies, and other policies. So the reason we're doing this is that in the past, we've talked a lot about research that's looked into the effectiveness of carbon pricing at reducing emissions. So in the past, we've always or very often said that studies have estimated that a carbon price can reduce emissions either by themselves or in combination with other policies to meet our Paris commitments. You can see one example of that on the right here. This is a chart from one of our favorites, the REMI study, showing what the carbon price was looking like, or what U.S. greenhouse gas emissions were looking like in business as usual in this blue, looking pretty flat, going up a little bit. And then this is with a carbon price in place, and specifically the Energy Innovation Act carbon price in place. And then you can see emissions going down significantly. You can also see that that started in 2015, and the REMI report was published in 2013. So it's now been over a decade since the REMI report was published, and it's a little outdated. And since then, we've also had the Inflation Reduction Act passed, which changed the climate policy and emissions landscape in the United States. And as noted, time has passed since all of these previous studies that we have referenced have been published. And so things have changed. And so we have actually wanted for a while to get a nice update on what a carbon price would do now that the Inflation Reduction Act has passed and now that it's 2024. And we finally got that. So we were very happy to see it. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. But a couple more examples. This is from our friends at RFF, Resources for Future. They have this great carbon pricing calculator tool on their website where you can like click on all the different carbon pricing bills that have been introduced in Congress and see various metrics surrounding them, including how much they would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So this green is the Energy Innovation Act. The gray is business as usual. Again, business as usual being pretty flat. And then the Inflation Reduction or the Energy Innovation Act reducing emissions significantly, again, getting to roughly cutting emissions by about half by 2030, similar to what the REMI report showed. But you can see this begins in 2020. So again, it's rather out of date. Another good example is this near-term net zero paper published by Noah Kaufman and his colleagues at Columbia. Which they were looking at what the carbon price structure would have to look like in combination with other complementary policies to get us to net zero by 2040 in the case of this red line, net zero by 2050 with this blue line, or by 2060 with this green line. And so you can see our official Paris target is net zero by 2050. So if you look at that blue one, you need a carbon price of $50 per ton in 2025. And $100 per ton in 2030 Which if the Energy Innovation Act had passed a few years ago, that's what a carbon price would have looked like in the United States. But it hasn't passed yet. Now it's 2024. And so this paper was published in 2020. So again, stuff's outdated. We need an update. And one challenge is that a lot of these different climate policies have similar effects. There's a lot of overlap between climate policies. So for example, if you look at this, this is our chart from the REMI report looking at where the emissions reductions would come from if a carbon price were passed, if the Energy Innovation Act were passed. You can see this blue is the big one, that's power generation. That means a lot. In fact, the majority of the emissions cuts would come from the electricity sector and then from some other stuff as well, but a big chunk from the electricity sector. And the Inflation Reduction Act, likewise, according to all of the modeling of the Inflation Reduction Act and its emissions reductions, most of them, there's like some disagreement about exactly how much, but most of the emissions reductions from the Inflation Reduction Act are also going to come from the power sector. So that in both cases, it's basically because the power sector is kind of the low-hanging fruit, because we've got lots of fossil fuel power that's relatively expensive. We got a bunch of coal power that's quite expensive. And then now we've got all this solar and wind power that's become quite relatively cheap. It's the most cost-effective new sources of power. And so it's pretty easy to install a bunch of solar and wind and replace the existing fossil fuel power. Relatively easy. And if you have a carbon price in place, then that makes the solar and wind even more cost-effective compared to the fossil fuels, and they went out, and so you get a bunch of clean power. Or in the case of the Inflation Reduction Act, we have a bunch of tax credits for clean electricity. And so because the solar and wind and other clean sources of electricity are getting these tax credits, again, they are relatively even more cheap compared to the fossil fuels. And so in both cases, you're basically taking these clean energy sources that are already like the most cost-effective and making them even more cost-effective. And so, boom, you get a whole bunch of wind and solar and the power sector becomes a lot cleaner. But the thing is, like, the Inflation Reduction Act is already doing that. And so the question is, like, if we do a carbon price, but the Inflation Reduction Act is already doing some of the stuff a carbon price would help do, how effective will it be? Or are there other policies that will be more effective, for example? And so that's the question is, like, today in our current policy landscape, how effective is a carbon price now? And so there was a really interesting report published on this by the Hamilton Project and Brookings Institution that kind of brought together a bunch of really great climate economists. And they took this interesting approach. And so if we could like take our time machine back to 2021 and think back to Build Back Better, the days when I was Build Back Better, before it became the Inflation Reduction Act, what was being considered in terms of climate policies was there were kind of three different approaches. One of them was basically a clean electricity standard, which is basically when you tell utilities you have to get X percent of your electricity from clean sources by a certain date, like 80% by 2030, for example. A challenge with that was that that is a regulatory approach. And you guys might remember during these negotiations, they were trying to get stuff done through the reconciliation process, their budget reconciliation process. And so, because they only had the 50 votes. And so to do that, anything going through the budget reconciliation process has to be budgetary in nature. And a clean electricity standard is not budgetary in nature. It is regulatory in nature. And so some smart folks came up with some kind of MacGyvering of the policy. And they said, okay, well, what if we say, if you don't meet this standard, then we'll penalize you some money. And if you do meet this standard, then we'll award you some money. Now there's money involved. And so now it's budgetary in nature. And maybe we could pass it through the budget reconciliation process. So that became the Clean Electricity Performance Program, or the CEPP, if you guys remember that from way back like 3 years ago. So that was one approach. Another approach they were, of course, considering was a price on carbon. We kept on hearing that that was part of the negotiations. And then the other thing that they tried to do was a bunch of clean technology tax credits and rebates. So the first thing to fall out was a clean electricity standard, or the CEPP. Where like Joe Manchin, for example, is like, this is not even really budgetary in nature. I don't buy this. It's a bad idea. And so it got cut in like August of 2021. We kept on hearing that price on carbon had like 49 votes in the Senate. We just needed to get that last Joe Manchin vote. And unfortunately, we never did. You know, there were inflation concerns at the time and it just didn't happen. And so that got cut out. But what did make it were those clean technology tax credits and rebates, the kind of subsidy carrot approach that everybody likes. And so it's very politically palatable. And so it was relatively easy to pass, if you can call what happened easy. At least it passed. So what Hamilton and Brookings did in this report was consider what would happen if we took the same three kinds of approaches in a post-Inflation Reduction Act world. So they said, what if now that we've passed the IRA, what if we do a clean electricity standard? What if we do a price on carbon? What if we expand the IRA or just maintain it as it is? Or what if it gets repealed by some future Congress that doesn't like it? And on top of that, they said, what about EPA regulations? Because we just, for example, got today final EPA rules on power plants. A few weeks ago, we got final EPA rules on vehicle tailpipe emissions. Those are going to be very helpful in reducing emissions. But there's a question of whether those will stick or not. And so they also considered that, what if the EPA regulations stick or what if they don't? And so they had seven different scenarios that they looked at. And we're going to look at those one at a time on this chart because you guys know how much I love charts. So here we've got our U.S. greenhouse gas emissions to date in the entire economy from 2005 through 2023 last year. Here is our Paris target trying to get to 50% cuts by right here by 2030. That's what we're trying to get to. And so this red line is basically the path that we're on now. If we keep the Inflation Reduction Act in place, don't touch it, and keep the EPA regulations, let those go into effect, and don't mess with those. So that gets us this red line. And so this red line, you can see it gets to the 50% cuts right here by about 2036. So it's about 6 years behind our schedule. You can see there's this gap here by 2030. So it's not good enough, but that's the path that we're on now. So that's our baseline. Then there's like the two worst scenario. So like bad scenario number one, it's like, okay, let's say we keep the Inflation Reduction Act. We don't pass any more climate legislation and the EPA regulations don't go into effect, which could happen, for example, if the next administration is not so friendly to climate regulations and decides to have their new EPA overturn them. Or if they're going to be challenged in court, so you could have an unfriendly court saying, you know, these are unconstitutional or they don't comply with the laws. And so for any of those reasons, the EPA regulations could be, they could not go into effect. In that scenario, you get this brown line, which is basically a continuation of kind of the path that we had been on of just like kind of slow and steady emissions reductions. You can see we get to that 50% cuts by about 2040. So basically it puts us about four more years behind where we would have been with the Inflation Reduction Act and the EPA regulations going into effect. So you lose about 4 years worth of progress there. Not great. There is a worse scenario. This is the last bad one we'll look at, but this is if you don't get the EPA regulations and a future Congress repeals most of the Inflation Reduction Act and they don't pass any new climate laws. So obviously that's all bad stuff. And you can see emissions, don't go down very much. So we're going to make sure that doesn't happen. So let's just set that aside and look at the better scenarios. So here's better scenario number one. This is if you keep your EPA regulations in place, you keep Inflation Reduction Act in place, and in fact, you boost the Inflation Reduction Act, you add some more subsidies, more tax credits, more rebates. So that's this green line. You can see it doesn't make much of a difference compared to the red line, because the Inflation Reduction Act already has a whole bunch of these incentives and subsidies. And so just adding some more, there's only so much more you can get. The bang for your buck has already been gotten. So it doesn't make a huge difference, but you get this little bit of extra emissions reductions. But you can see that gets to 50% cuts by about 2035 or so. So it's basically like 1 year better, but still well short of our Paris target of getting there by 2030. You still miss it by about 4 or 5 years. Next scenario is our clean electricity standard, assuming that the Inflation Reduction Act stays in place and the EPA regulations stay in place, and you're just adding a clean electricity standard. It's this blue line. You can see it doesn't do much more than the green line, because, as I noted before, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's already doing a lot to decarbonize the power sector. So like if you do this clean electricity standard, it only targets the electricity sector and says electricity sector, you have to get X percentage of clean electricity by a certain date. But the Inflation Reduction Act's already doing a lot of that, but with all these clean electricity tax credits. So again, you get a little bit more. You're about the same as the green line. You still get to 50% cuts by like 2034. So you're still 4 years too short. It's a little better than our status quo, but it's not much better. It's not good enough to meet our Paris targets. So then we got the two scenarios that we like with a carbon price. The first one is this purple one, which is if you do a carbon price. A carbon price they looked at is similar to the Energy Innovation Act. It starts at $15 per ton, but it only goes up at $5 per ton per year, whereas the Energy Innovation Act goes up by $10 per ton per year. So it's like a decent but less ambitious carbon price than in the Energy Innovation Act. But with that carbon price, they put that in place, but they also say, let's assume that a future Congress wants to repeal part of the Inflation Reduction Act. So they keep the clean energy tax credits in place. They keep some nuclear stuff in place, but they get rid of a lot of the rebates and tax credits for like home electrification and efficiency and electric cars and stuff like that. They take all that out, I guess, to kind of, let's assume that a future Congress wants to save some money. So then you get this purple line. You can see it gets to the 50% cuts by about 2032, 2033. So it's doing better. It's significantly better than these other scenarios with the clean electricity standard or just boosting the Inflation Reduction Act. You see, especially over the future years, because you continue to hit the entire economy with a carbon price, it does do pretty well, but it's still coming up short of our Paris targets of the 50% by 2030. And then the final scenario is the best one that we like. It is that same carbon price. Less ambitious than the Energy Innovation Act, but still a good carbon price, keeping the Inflation Reduction Act in place, keeping the EPA regulations in place. So in that case, you can see emissions go down quite significantly. It gets to close to 50% cuts by 2030. Not quite there, but I think if we were also to implement permitting reform and maximize the potential of the Inflation Reduction Act, then permitting reform plus a carbon price, I think, would get us to 50% cut by 2030. And we'll see that here in a little bit. So that is the best of all the scenarios. It gets the most emissions cuts. So you can see carbon price in a post-IRA world is really the way to go. Reason being is that it hits all sectors of the economy. So like it is hitting the electricity sector, which the IRA is also hitting, but it also hits like industry and transportation. Like it hits all the other industries too. And so it gives them also an incentive to decarbonize. And so that's why you see those additional emissions cuts compared to, for example, just doing a clean electricity standard that just hits the electricity sector. So in terms of emission cuts, carbon price is the way to go. And they looked at a few different factors in all of these different scenarios. So for example, they looked at how much emissions would be cut by 2030, by 2035. They also looked at cost effectiveness of each of these different scenarios, which is like a complicated thing because you're looking at the cost effectiveness of a bunch of different overlapping policies. But nevertheless, you can like consider like the overall cost effectiveness of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in terms of dollars per ton in each of these like combinations of things that are going on. And you can also look at what it will do to our monthly home energy bills in 2030 and what it will do to the budget, where here a positive number means it's going to bring money back into the federal budget and help us like reduce the deficit. A negative number means it's going to cost money. And so it's an additional thing that will be added to the federal deficit. So you can kind of go one by one and say like our kind of business as usual with the help of the EPA regulations, we would get to about 42% cuts by 2030. Without the EPA regulations and without the IRA, then you're well short of your Paris commitments by 2030. And then you can think, okay, what if we boost the Inflation Reduction Act? That'll get you like 1% more by 2030, 2% more by 2035. So it's not a big difference if you just boost the IRA. It doesn't give you a whole lot more. It's a little bit, but not a whole lot more. If you do your clean electricity standard, that's kind of similar. It gets you an extra 1% the Inflation Reduction Act boost by 2030 and 2035. It's pretty similar, not a big difference. Again, still leaving you well short of your Paris commitments. And then the carbon price scenarios. If you just do a carbon price and repeal some of the IRA stuff, it gets you to 45%. And if you keep it all with the carbon price, you get to 47%. But again, if you do permitting reform, you can boost that even further and get to 50% by 2030. And if you look down further down the line, you can see like the carbon price gets you a big amount of reductions in the ensuing 5 years, because again, it keeps hitting the economy with this rising carbon price and incentivizing all different sectors to decarbonize, that they're not having to pay this carbon price. They're finding cheaper ways to reduce their emissions. And because the carbon price is creating that economic signal and motivation to reduce emissions in the most cost-effective way possible, it's also a very cost-effective way to reduce emissions. You can see those two scenarios where the carbon price is the least dollars per ton in terms of reducing emissions. If you do a carbon price and you repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, then you're saving those government subsidies, and so it's like even cheaper. But you get less emissions reductions, so there's that trade-off. I should also add, all these are not particularly expensive. Like a benchmark we tend to use for what's a reasonable cost for a climate policy is $100 per ton. Like anything less than that is reasonably priced. And so all of these are well below $100 per ton. So these are all generally good ways to reduce emissions. But significantly cheaper than the other ones is the scenarios with a carbon price. It's the most cost-effective way to do things. Because, for example, if you are, let's say you're boosting the Inflation Reduction Act, you're doing all these subsidies for specific clean electricity technologies, you're doing tax credits for electric cars and things, different, just you're sending money to specific technologies, you're kind of picking winners, and maybe you're not sending the most optimal amount of money to each different technology. And so it's less cost effective to send money to specific technologies than it is to just put a price on carbon, say, hey, market, find the most cost effective way to reduce your emissions. And then they'll find the best technologies rather than the government sending a set amount of money to each technology and being reduce emissions. That's less cost effective. And then these last two columns are sort of trade-offs, because basically the more the government is shelling out, then that results in cheaper electricity prices generally for households. So you can think of, for example, a carbon price that's going to generate revenue for the federal government in the form of the price that polluters are paying. But as they pay that price for their pollution, that's also going to make them increase the price of at least the electricity and other products that are associated with those that carbon pollution. And so electricity prices and other prices do go up, but you can see they don't go up a whole lot, because in the electricity sector, we still have a lot of cheap wind and solar that we can install that we can do at a relatively cheap cost. And so it's not a big increase in home energy bills if you just do a carbon price. And it also generates some money for the federal government, which, again, we would like to see that money sent back to households in the form of dividends, but it is budgetarily positive. Whereas, for example, if you're doing stuff with the Inflation Reduction Act, let's say you boost the Inflation Reduction Act, then you're increasing the amount of subsidies being sent out by the government. The government's having to shell out more money, and so that is an increase in the cost to the federal budget. But as a result, electricity prices go down, because now you're subsidizing this clean electricity. You get all this cheap clean electricity that makes energy bills go down. So it's kind of a trade-off. You're getting cheap household energy bills, but you're also, that cost is basically being added to the federal government. So something to consider when you're considering the policies is where does the money come from? Where does it go? Who benefits? Who's paying for it? So that's kind of an interesting thing to consider here. So that was the Hamilton-Brookings report of carbon pricing in a post-IRA world. I also wanted to touch on this other report published by the Climate Leadership Council, They've been doing a lot of education about the report themselves, so we didn't want to like step on their toes too much, but we just wanted to touch on it a little bit. So they did a similar thing, although they had kind of a technology-based model that they did, and they basically said, if you put a price on carbon, how much will it help these clean technologies win out in the marketplace, and how much will that reduce emissions? So they said that the baseline, the current path that we're on, will reduce emissions 32% by 2030, which I would say is like Inflation Reduction Act without any permitting reform. We could consider like a pessimistic Inflation Reduction Act, assuming we don't get permitting reform passed, was their baseline. And then they added the influence of a carbon price on top of that. They did their preferred, the CLC's preferred carbon price, which is starts at $40 per ton, and then it rises at 5% per year. Which is a little different than our carbon price. And I compared them actually on this chart, where the green one is the Energy Innovation Act, starting at $15, going up $10 per year. The red is the Hamilton Brookings, which starts at the same spot as ours, but only goes up $5 per ton per year. And the blue is the Climate Leadership Council, which starts at $40 per ton, and it goes up 5% per year. So if those were all to go into effect in 2025, ours would surpass theirs in about 2028, 2029. And the Brookings Hamilton would meet theirs in about 2035. But before that, it would stay below. So these are both generally less overall ambitious carbon prices than the Energy Innovation Act, although the Climate Leadership Council starts at a higher level. It just doesn't rise very fast. So this figure shows that the emissions pathways under these various different scenarios, the green is just historical emissions, the blue is our Paris targets, so we're trying to get to that 50% cuts by 2030 and then net zero by 2050, and then the red is their current policy, which again is like an Inflation Reduction Act without permitting reform, and then the brown is what they project or what they model emissions would look like if we passed their $40 per ton carbon price. And so you can see that would get us to 42% cuts by 2030. Although again, I think that's basically a 10% drop from their baseline. So if their baseline were like a Inflation Reduction Act with permitting reform, if that started at 40% cuts, if we were to pass permitting reform and maximize the potential of the Inflation Reduction Act, and then you add 10% on top of that from a carbon price, that would actually get us to 50% cuts by 2030. So I think IRA plus permitting reform plus carbon price equals meeting our Paris target in 2030. And then by 2050, they have about 87% cuts in emissions from their carbon price plus the Inflation Reduction Act by 2050. So not quite getting to our net zero. So you still have to do some complementary policies to get to our net zero, but it gets us most of the way there. So again, very effective thing to do, passing a carbon price according to both of these modeling efforts. So using the data from those two reports, we decided it would be a good time to update this chart of the emissions reductions wedges from the CCL policy agenda. So we're going to see what that looks like here. Again, this is our emissions to date from 2005 to 2023. And this is our Paris target, 50% cuts by 2030. So we're trying to get to that point. This is our pre-Inflation Reduction Act pathway, where we were headed for something in the ballpark of 27% cuts by 2030. So coming up almost halfway short for our Paris commitments before the Inflation Reduction Act was passed. By itself, the Inflation Reduction Act would get us to something like 31% cuts. Although if we would actually additionally be effective in our education about the home electrification and efficiency incentives, the tax credits and rebates for people to electrify and make their homes more energy efficient in the Inflation Reduction Act. Plus, we're also doing some other building electrification and efficiency things, like we have the school electrification challenge. We're doing some state electrification and efficiency policies. And so if we can get all that done, we can get a few more percent, get us down to 33% cuts by 2030. And then if we can get permitting reform done, which we're hoping we're going to see soon from Congress, some kind of permitting reform bill, if we can get that done and maximize the potential of the IRA, then we think we can get to 40% cuts by 2030. And then if we can get a carbon price passed on top of that, that should get us to our 50% emissions cuts by 2030 and reach our Paris commitments. But then on top of that, we're still going to be working on healthy forests, trying to get some associated forest legislation passed, maybe some this year, maybe some in the Farm Bill, which might be happening next year. So we're going to keep working on that. So if we can get that done, we can get another maybe 5% emissions are removed from the atmosphere, and we can actually get to something like 55% cuts by 2030 and actually surpass our Paris commitments and set a good example for other countries. Because right now there aren't very many countries that are surpassing their Paris commitments. Most countries are well behind their Paris commitments, including at this point the United States. So if we can get CCL's full agenda implemented, taking all this data into consideration, we think we can actually surpass what we committed to do under the Paris Agreement, which would be very nice to see. So we'll finish up here before we take some questions, looking at what's up next for carbon pricing in Congress. One key thing that's happening is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was a bunch of tax cuts that were passed in about 2017, I believe, 2016 maybe. Those are set to expire at the end of 2025. And so there's going to be some big tax negotiations happening next year in Congress. So that's because extending all those tax cuts and like, nobody likes ending tax cuts because that's like a tax increase, but extending all those tax cuts would cost over $3 trillion, which is a lot of money to be adding to the federal deficit that people don't want to add. And so then if you don't want to do that, you either need to end the tax cuts or you need to find some revenue to pay for extending some of those tax cuts. One really good source of revenue is putting a price on carbon pollution. So there is certainly some interest in that for next year. We'll be keeping an eye on that and probably be trying to play a role in those negotiations and encouraging Congress to maybe pass a price on carbon in 2025. But we will keep our ears to the ground and see what happens. It'll also depend on what happens in the forthcoming election and what Congress looks like next year and how much they care about tax cuts and federal deficits. So that remains to be seen, but there is kind of an opening in Congress for a carbon price to be negotiated next year. The other big thing that's happening is all these talks about carbon tariffs and carbon border adjustment mechanisms, CBAMs, that we've been talking about a lot this year with, for example, Republican Senators Cassidy and Graham introducing the Foreign Pollution Fee Act, which would put a tariff on the extra carbon content of stuff that we import from other countries if it's more carbon intensive than the equivalent we make in the United States. There's also a CBAM bill from Senator Whitehouse that's very similar, although it also put a price on domestic carbon. So there's kind of a Democratic bill and a Republican bill, and they're kind of trying to figure out what they can do with that. In the meantime, in order to do any of these carbon tariffs or CBAMs, you have to have the data of how carbon intensive all these different industries are from different countries compared to the intensity of the American equivalent. And so that's why we're advocating for the PROVE IT Act to have the Department of Energy do those calculations and ascertain the carbon intensity differences between American industries and their foreign equivalents in every different country. That's going to take several years to do all those calculations. We want them to get started now so that they can then, while they're figuring out what to do about carbon tariffs and border adjustments, those calculations can be happening and they don't have to worry about that in their bills. Also, the European Union is in the process of doing those calculations themselves because they are going to do a CBAM starting in 2026. So they're doing the calculations right now to figure out what the CBAM is going to have to look like because you have to know the carbon intensity differences between countries to apply that. And so if the European Union is doing those calculations, we don't just want to rely on their calculations. Like, we want to do the calculations ourselves to make sure that we agree with them. So there's a lot of good reasons to do the PROVE IT Act very soon. We may be advocating for it in the June conference, and hopefully we can get it passed this year. Right now in the Senate, it's got a lot of bipartisan support. It's got 7 Democrats and 5 Republicans co-sponsoring in the Senate. We hope we're going to see a House version pretty soon. And as I said, we may be lobbying for it pretty soon as well. So that's kind of the Next up, for carbon pricing in Congress, that's what we expect to see in the coming months and year or two.
But before anything else, just a huge round of applause. And thank you so much, Dana, for that great, great presentation. And then lastly, after tonight, if we don't get to all of the questions, since we have a great slew of them here already, Dan has generously provided his email as well as a link to Nerd Corner, which I've also put in the chat, cclusa.org/nerd-corner. Thank you all so much for being here tonight yourselves. Thank you for your advocacy and engagement. And we hope you found tonight's training useful. Keep up the great work. And we look forward to seeing you back here on the next training.
Thank you, guys. Excellent.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks,
Thank
Dana.
You.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration.
Like what you hear? Recommend us to your friends and make sure to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us show up on other listeners' feeds. Feel free to pass on any suggestions for future episodes in the comments as well.
And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.